you go down a mountain called Sheer Mountain, and there are all these little road signs that say pass with care. Our signs say do not pass or no passing, but that particular sign says pass with care. And the first time that I ever saw that sign, I thought, well, that's great. You know, I mean, it doesn't lay down ground rules, don't do this, don't do that. It, you know, it just tells you to be careful. And so after the flood, I drove with a friend back down to Petersburg and back down through Wango and Pendleton County, where the flood just did a super lot of damage. And there were those signs again. And at the same time, I was thinking about a title for this book. And I thought to myself, that pass with care can mean a lot more than just be careful. It can mean, for example, how we pass through a terrible disaster, mainly through the caring of so many people across the United States who sent tons of food and money and clothing and, you know, just everything to help the people in West Virginia. I know in Tucker County alone, there was over $300,000 that was donated to TIRE, which was a Tucker County interreligious group that set up a sort of an office to help people get what they needed, you know. And so that seemed to be an appropriate cover for this book, because a lot of this book, a lot of these poems that I'm probably not going to get time to read to you today, you'll have to read them in the book, are about all the caring and sharing that went on in probably the greatest effort that man will ever see in Tucker County. And so I wrote this one called He's Your Brother. Life isn't worth a fiddler's damn if you can't make a difference somehow. In the tide of affairs that wash over our days in search of a head to bow. If you see a heart that's breaking or a friend with a heavy load and you can't make his burdens lighter, then you've missed the sign by the road. If you haven't got time for a helping hand or even a kind word to share, then you've lost the message God gave us. He's your brother, pass with care. And
the book, by the way, has a commentary.
Yes.
Running along with the poems about how they came to be written, the background of each one, and so on. So I've never seen a book quite like this one. Maybe.
And this one I called The Game of Friends, and this was after I'd watched a TV show about with some guys playing poker. Gave me all these ideas. Life's like a game of poker, and friends are there when you win. But when you have a run of bad luck, the crowd begins to thin. While Lady Luck is smiling, steadfast behind you they stand. Then fall away like a house of cards, leaving you to play the hand. Now many folks say I'll be your friend, but when the going gets rough, you'll find only one in a million still there when you call in the bluff. And I wrote this for a lady, so. In you, my friend, is that loyalty, unwavering, steady, and true. Like a once-in-a-lifetime royal flush, I'm blessed having dealt hands with you. I do a lot of these poems to thank. I write my own thank you notes, my own Christmas cards, you know, and all that. So these are scattered all over the place. And this one is about the old house where we used to live, and I went back a long time afterwards, and the house, of course, had been torn down, and then what was left of the logs had rotted up, and so I read the poem. I call it Just Stones and Daffodils. Once a little cabin nestled in a hollow between the hills, but the only thing remaining now are stones and daffodils. Stones that once were cut by callous hands and placed precisely so, that the logs fit on exactly as if nature made them grow. And the yellow flowers blooming caused a pang inside my heart, for I guess I thought my cabin and the earth would never part. But no matter how we labor and water ground with sweat, and our life's blood fairly given, it will all revert as net. For nature's hand will wipe away scars of good or bad we've sown, and the only thing remaining will be daffodils and stones. Oh, here's my one about the balcony. I found it. I called it Don't Give Up. The balcony's already closed. The show has just begun. The ticket booth has a sold-out sign, and the credits have been run. The house down the street has a broken glass in the picture window frame. The ball that was thrown so carelessly can never go back whence it came. Because the loose shoe wasn't fastened, the horse didn't win the race. The cup's on the shelf, and the bets have been paid, and the second in line has first place. And it seems that life has gone sour. All you touch turns into disarray. The multitude looks to the winner, and the losers are lost by the way. So you broke the glass, and you missed the show, and you lost it all for a nail. If you don't give up when life gets tough, nobody can say that you failed. And sometimes of a night, you know, just when you can't sleep and you're just lying there listening to all the noise. And this was on a windy night that I wrote this. The wind is crying tonight in the hills, a low and mournful wail. Its painful pitch takes solace away and batters emotions like hail. And the night seems alive with the noise as I listen and wait for a dream. An unexplainable sadness sets in and I'm caught in its devilish scheme. I feel suspended mid-motion, like a frame in a movie set still. Then my body's rushed on by the crying wind and my voice is lost in the hills. Sometimes I write little prayers and things. I come from a religious background. My father was a minister, and so, you know, I believe in God, and it comes out in everything I do. I call this one my prayer. Give me wings to fly above envy, O Lord, when I meet those who've accomplished more than I have been given the power to gain, though temptation strikes me sore. Give me the sight of an eagle, Lord, to see the good in all men, that I might never lose the faith I have in each newfound friend. Lord, give me the memory of an elephant, so that I will never forget the kindness someone showered on me when along life's path we met. Let me never get higher than bended knees so that I can always pray and thank you, Lord, for the wonderful things that have happened to me today. And this one I called Life's Beginning. It's, I thought how strange it was that by the time we, you know, by the time we're old enough to appreciate life and to enjoy life, it's time to die. And so I call this one Life's Beginning. Have you ever thought how great it would be to live our lives in reverse and start out with all the wisdom we've learned and end up with the innocence of birth? We'd already know where the pitfalls are and we'd have no mistakes to regret. We'd already have our fortune made. We wouldn't have reason to fret. We'd know what's important to living and what is worthwhile to learn. Our children would have the best of care. We wouldn't have bridges to burn. We'd know the true purpose of being alive and the right pathway to trod. Our lives would be pure as little babes held in the arms of God. It would be nice if we, you know, when your children are all grown up and sometimes you look back and you think, boy, I should have known better than to do this or that. My problem is that, you know, when my mother was alive, I actually did this to her. Sometimes I treated her like she was senile, you know, and I'd act like, you know, I know more. You know how you do, and you don't really value all those opinions that they have, and you say, "Oh, Mom, you know, that isn't the way it's done anymore." Now it's happening to me. I don't really like that. My son says, "Oh, Mom, you're living in the dark ages," or "Oh, Mom." How naive can you get, Mom? But anyway, when I was small at home, and my mother had the same disease that I have, and I always thought that Daddy sort of pampered her a lot, but I guess he really didn't, because a lot of times he was away from home working, you know. But he didn't marry my mother till he was 42. They didn't have any children then for 4 years, so he was 46 when my oldest brother was born. He was 48 when I was born, and he was 60 when my youngest brother was born. And so by this time, it was pretty hard for him to get a job, you know. He did all kinds of odd jobs, but we really didn't have a lot of money. Sometimes I resented that when I was growing up, you know, and other children had things a lot nicer than I did. So I wrote this one quite some time ago. This one was one that survived the flood, and I called it God's People. If you're born to a hard luck family where fancy has never been style, then you'll grow up tough like I did, and you'll learn to face life with a smile. For the frowning just brings back old troubles, and memories aren't warm, light, or glad. And it's easier to smile and forget them than to dwell on the hurt and the sad. You'll never be glad to see winter adorned with the fluffy white snow, for the cold creeps in spite of the heat and chills you right down to your toes. And you'll think of the days round a wood stove that poets write cozy and warm, but all you'll remember is the cold at your back and the roar of a long winter storm. And summer will always be season you love cause it made you fit in, your bare feet and river-cleaned body made being poor less of a sin. You may never learn to like beefsteak, your taste runs bologna and spam, and the elegant specialty seafood brings back smell of bass in a pan. So many bad things I remember, the hopeless prayers as a child, like waiting for Santa at Christmas and last year's Valentine's filed, so you wouldn't give back to the sender with the names quite never erased, and then the agony of high school as a year without money was faced. But when you've discovered the question of why did this happen to me, why couldn't my family be wealthy with a life of easy and free? The answer will follow in recourse without the slightest of pause. God made the poor to be special, or else the world would be small. So I find answers to all those things that bother me. Am I running out of time?
Another 10 minutes if you can possibly
come.
Okay.
Maybe I could tell you a little bit about our background. You might be interested in. My husband's family came from Pendleton County back in probably the early 1800s or something like that, and settled in almost a section that no one had been in before, and that's why he's still such a mountain man. They built their own house, of course, and they built their own furniture, and they hunted and and raised their own food and everything, and they were very self-reliant people, you know. And it was really hard after the flood for him to be on the receiving end of things rather than the giving end, you know. My husband had four brothers, but only one sister. She died real young. So girls have always been special to him, you know. And when, you know, we ended up with a little granddaughter. And she calls him her pawpaw. And so every time she loves horses, she loves ponies. One day we're going to have to buy one. But in the meantime, my husband ends up being the horse, you know. Every time they come up, he has to take her for a horseyback ride, you know. And sometimes he complains. But anyway, I took a photograph of her on on his back. And I called it the Papaw horse. If I can find it, I thought I had it out here. Oh, here we go. And I said, when you're 4 years old and life is so new, filled with little girl joy, of course, there's nothing so grand or so glorious as a ride on a Papaw horse. For this horse rides so smoothly with only a few gentle bucks, but to shake out a cute little giggle, with only a few gentle bucks, to shake out a cute little giggle, but for speed you'd be out of luck. 'Cause this horse can't go quite so fast anymore, and sometimes his knees creak and groan. But when he carries this rider, envy not a king or his throne. But anyway, the people in his family have always had horses to do their work with, and before the flood, we used this horse to plow the gardens and do the mowing of the hay and all kind of things like that, you know, and skid wood in and everything. And that's why the horse was so special to him, you know, because he used it. It was his workmate. And even though he teased people that sometimes he hooked me up in all that harness, it was the horse that did it. So after the flood, I thought, well, he had to have another horse, you know. He just had to have another horse. So somebody heard about it, and there was a fund called Christmas in the Hills. And so someone evidently wrote in or something, and we got a check for $50 toward a horse for Norman. So I put $50 with it, making $100, and we went and bought this colt for him. And so I took a photograph during a photography class of him hugging this horse, you know. It's in the book. And I wrote this poem called The Master's Touch, because it takes a special person to be able to take a horse and really work with it. I can't at all. As a matter of fact, this horse, even now, he's a couple years old, you know, and Norman can do anything with him. But sometimes he comes to the gate and he won't even let me through the gate, you know. And he just stands there and he won't let me through. Except a couple weeks ago when we had a Rebecca convention in Parsons, and I forgot some chances we were selling on something or other, and I had to run all the way back home and from Parsons. It's about 3 miles, and get those chances and have them back down there so we could have the drawing for the Afghan that day or something. And the old horse was standing there in my way, you know, and I'm rushing to get through, and just right there he is. And I told him, I said, you just get the hell out of my way. I don't have time to fool with you today. And he just turned tail and went to the barn as hard as he could. But usually, I'm no good with animals that are bigger than I am. But Norman has this way with horses, so I called this the Master's Touch. Oh, a man and his horse, it's a wonderful thing, the camaraderie that lies in between. The trust of the horse and the master who loves sets the mold and the cast it will bring. Once on wobbly legs, the horse colt ran free in a meadow all fragrant and green, warm mother beside with the gentlest nudge and the song of a cool mountain spring. But he learned if he bit that mother would kick, and the bumblebee stung his soft nose, that the clover was sweet, but the thorns you can't eat on the shoots of a wild mountain rose. When he grew straight and strong, mother pushed him aside, and man came with halter in hand, and he shivered in fear as the person drew near, but curiosity narrowed the span. Then the halter was slipped on his head, buckled firm. As he stood, legs braced, nostrils flared. But soft, gentle hands soothed his shivering sides, and he wondered, why should I be scared? Soon he learned that the man wouldn't hurt like the bee, or the thorns of the rose when he chewed, and the sweet taste of grain put aside thought of pain, and the trust between man and horse grew. Thus the lessons of life, much like that of the horse, man must learn in his fight to survive. With the master to lead us and trust through the fields, the thorns won't cut quite so deep, and love's sweet rewards, like the grain for the horse, will replace the bitter with sweet. have this book that you can, like I say, write down if you would, your name and address, if you would like to have one of these books.
I have a large
fabric here. Are there any questions I could, anything you'd like to talk about?
In an art class recently, there were some kids, and I don't know the language of art or writing, but there were some kids who were talking about saying they had overworked their picture. They'd better quit and leave it alone. And I wondered how, you said you hadn't finished that one poem. And I wondered how you know when it's finished. How long you keep working and changing.
I rarely ever like this. See, I just meant that I hadn't typed it up yet.
Okay. Do you rewrite and change things around?
Very little. You can see how many corrections I've made on that.
From the beginning to now.
Yeah. And I write that in maybe 20 minutes.
You just do it almost as a flow.
Right. Okay. So there's very little changes on it.
Yeah.
I just. Maybe a word here or there that I really don't have any training, and I think I slept through the part of school that was grammar and only woke up for the literature. And then when I started writing this book, I thought I forgot everything that I'd ever known about English. But thank goodness I had a great lady, Kate Long, you probably know her too, edit the thing for me, and so it's all coming together, and Augusta is financing the book, and it's being printed in Parsons, and at Superior.
The part that is not poetry, did you write that also,
Yes.
Did you enjoy writing that prose instead of poetry? Did you enjoy writing that?
Well, a lot of it I put on a tape recorder and Kate typed it up.
So it's an oral explanation.
That's really an oral explanation.
Uh-huh.
Do you have these on tape?
No. That would just be in the book. Michael probably has a lot of them because this makes three or four times up.
Do you read your poems to your friends? And?
Yes, uh-huh. As a matter of fact, I'll be at Canane Lodge on the 14th and 28th of August for like their campfire nature study. I usually don't take pay, even though I got paid for Augusta last year and it sure came in handy. Because we building the house took a lot of money. But usually I don't take pay. I just, Canane will give me, they offered me a free weekend, but I live within 12 miles, so why would you? And my husband wouldn't enjoy Canane anyway.
I'm from near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I'm rather active in our church and Sunday school, and there are many places I'd love to, just take the book and I think I could read and explain about you and entertain for a half hour,
Oh, it would be great.
It sounds great.
Well, as a matter of fact, I won't read it to you, but I have a poem in here that I wrote for the Presbyterian Church in Parsons. That I call my $2,000 poem. This gal called me after the flood, and she was going to the conference, I believe at Bluestone, and she wanted to thank all of those people who had helped rebuild the Presbyterian Church after the flood. The entire business section in Parsons was practically leveled, and the church was destroyed Well, the brick building, of course, was okay, but the place was in a shambles, and so all these people came in and shoveled mud and hosed down, and you just wouldn't believe the amount of work that went on. So they were really grateful, and she wanted me to write a poem for her rather than just to get up and say thank you. She wanted something special. So I wrote this poem for her, and she took it to the conference and read it. And they said after she read it, you could have heard a pin drop. And then she got a standing ovation. And the church was so impressed that they gave me a check for $2,000, which helped build my house. And my husband, before this, had said, it's a waste of time. It's a bunch of junk writing down all this stuff. Well, let me tell you, he ate crow when I weighed a $10,000 check under his nose. Do you want me to read it?
Yes.
Okay. See, you can, this was the original. You can see there's a few changes on it. On a chilly November evening in 1985, after rain had fallen for several days like the heavens had chosen to cry, a flood came down on our little town and nothing could withstand its rage. And the Parsons Presbyterian Church lay like book with an open page. In the hands of a child too young to care, it was crushed and crumpled inside, and little remained of the beauty we'd wrought and looked on with infamous pride. The white-painted pews were tossed every way, encrusted with mud murky brown. Books, hymnals, and Bibles joined soggy and wet in debris piled like huge beaver mounds. Porch pillars were broken, windows smashed by the force. Only building strong structure was spared, and the beautiful stained glass window we'd saved, back of altar, unbroken, still fair. But the task to clean up, monumental in size, seemed like mountain too steep for decline. Then the help poured in from friends who cared, and it was a wonderful sign of realization that we weren't alone. God sent his people to care for the hurt in our hearts and the spirits so low, the problems of life they did share. More than 50 young people from Charleston schools, church folks from all walks of life, with shovels and hoses, brooms, buckets and mops, worked together to ease our sad plight. There was money and food, pianos and books, and organs, church hymnals too. New Bibles and furniture for those who had lost, love of friends and neighbors so true. And from people in Parsons I've come to express the thanks we could never name all. For there's Greenbrier and Parkersburg and Grafton Ohio Valley churches and so many more. To write them all down would take pages a score. And so if you helped or know others who did, would you please just tell them for us that the kindness they gave changed cynical minds and planted once more a seed of trust. In the greatest commandment God gave us to do, love others as much as oneself. And because of these acts in our time of need, the thanks we send truly heartfelt. And so every time we kneel in the church or sing a glad song of praise, we'll think of the friends who cared enough to help us along the rough way. And maybe someday we can repay by helping another in need. But if not, we'll just thank the good Lord and ask his blessing on all of your deeds. So that was my $2,000 poem.
Wow. Lita gave the convocation here last fall. The convocation was
to discuss poetry and to exchange poems and have readings, you know. And when I heard their poems, I thought, oh Lord, there must be something wrong with mine, because mine was the only one that rhymed. They wrote verses so deep and you know, you really had to dig for the meaning. And I thought there must be something wrong with mine.
No, it's just that I still write in rhyme.
They really enjoyed it.
And I think that many people listen to rhyme with deep gratitude, because it is usually something that we can all understand.
Well, it really doesn't work well for me. For example, I brought one here that I was gonna go over briefly to show you what happens when I try to write things kind of deep. This one I was trying to use less words, you know, not be so verbose. And I said, sitting alone, looking at a crooked wall, cracked and peeling, so sad and dull it feels like me. Happiness gone, lost between dawn of birth and dusk of day finish, making my heart heavy, broken, peeling, and dull, sad like a crooked wall. Straining to fall, held by a beam, waiting for the carpenter to repair and make darkness into light. But what I wanted to say was, that old house, you know, it's a mess. It made me feel bad to even walk in it and look at it. But this doesn't work.
Can you give these, you know, checks or money
to me?
Okay.
Yeah, just make it out to the paper.
No, Norman Law.